Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Visit one of our 44 stores across Ireland for quality curtains and bedding at great prices. Find your perfect style today.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. I want to bring in Anita now. Anita, good afternoon.
Oh my goodness, good afternoon. Hi, Katie.
Did I give you a fright, Anita?
Well, yes, the phone call did. Yes, I'm just out planting up acorns at the moment.
Oh, right. That is very appropriate if you're out planting acorns, Anita. Just to say, you got in touch with us. We had a programme yesterday that started off with a complaint or a caller being taken aback by being asked for 5 cents for his paper bag in Easons. Took off with a very interesting conversation about what we should or shouldn't be doing to help our environment and to help forestation and all of that. And you have very strong views on this, Anita.
Right. Well, I think it was Shane and Owen rang me. I had just sent a message in a few weeks back about they were talking about birds, what birds I could hear. But I really think everybody has to do their own bit. You know, we've only, you know, people say, oh, our planet is one in a million. Unfortunately, it's the only one. And we have got no chimney and we have got no plug hole for the filth and the heat that we're creating. And unfortunately, we're poisoning this. It's like a room. Mother Earth is in the room and she is sustaining us. And all we're doing is creating pollution and exploiting. And I just find it so hard to understand people who say, well, look, I'm doing this. Look, it won't affect me. I won't be around. I mean, and they have a child. They expect their child to grow up with what we're leaving them. I get so frustrated, but I do think at this stage, you just have to do what you can yourself. And everybody, you're faced with decisions every day with what you do, what you put down your toilet, what you put down your sink, what you burn. And you've got to think. We all think we've a divine right to do what we like. We don't. We have a responsibility. Anyway.
And tell me, and you say you're out there planting acorns today. You know, you feel that we should be preserving wild spaces. That we're turning beautiful places into theme parks.
I do. Yeah, that's what your researcher rang about. Just because there's an area of cliff or what, it doesn't mean we have a right to, you know, lay the tarmac, bring the dogs out and walk there. We're ruining nesting spots. I was heartbroken just to see, you know, everywhere you go now, there's another poster up and you can go on this walk here, that walk there. And the whole coastline is becoming a border of walks for us. And it's pushing nesting birds to the brink. I can't understand why people have to have, you know, their selfie with the puffin, their selfie with this. Could we, you know, we've got to live together. We're part of nature. Could we not just bring the coastal walk back in at some places and preserve an area for the nesting birds?
Are we talking about like greenways and you know, paved walks? Yeah, is that what you're talking? Because I just recently noticed somebody basically raising that issue, saying, "How green are green waves really?" Because, you know, this is nature, and one way or another, we're interfering with it when we're building greenways.
Well, I suppose, you know, the old railways, there's a route there anyway, but it's the coastal paths that I think are doing huge damage. And walkers, again, think we've a right to let our dog run loose everywhere. Try, you know, hearing a skylark now around Tramore, Waterford, Dunmore East. They're gone. There's not one. And, you know, people going on walks, if they just keep the dog on the lead, the skylarks nest in the grass. Up the back of me here, the shell duck nest in the heather up on the hill. And a week ago, a guy was out, let his three hounds up, you know, all let them run off. That's the end of the shell duck's nest. You know, yeah. People have to think what we're left with. Birds are under huge pressure, especially, you know, seabirds with bird flu, loss of their food. And we've got to treasure what we have.
And do you think, because I think people do, and I think Irish people in particular, have a closeness with nature and they do appreciate it when they're in it. But do you think that we're getting a bit of too much distance? Is that the problem?
No. You say when they're in it. The big problem, I think, with us, now, I'm kind of shaking talking to you, Casey, so I'm pretending I'm just talking to you, that this is not live. But we seem to think we're separate from nature. We're not. We have this weird Western colonial attitude that we own this farm or this land or this planet, and we can exploit it, control it, and take what we like. We can't. We're at a point now where the world climate is breaking down. You know, we talk about, oh, well, look, it's all in the future. It's not in the future. There are people now who have no future with droughts, with flooding, with famine. And we're part of this planet. We're part of this earth. And we've got to start changing our attitude that we don't own and control. We are part of it. We are equal to the birds, the plants. We're all made of the same thing. And we've got to start respecting the planet and each other. Otherwise, we're fecked.
How far would you go in terms of what we should stop doing in terms of how our place in this world? In terms of...
Well, I think in the future... I do believe, now that you're asking, I do believe that people in the future will look back on our attitude to flying, the way we think, oh, I can go on a stag party to Prague, let's get married in Malaga, let's go and visit Granny in wherever, or let's visit somebody in Australia, let's go to the Galapagos just because we can. People in the future will look on our attitude to flying as a crime against humanity. We know the facts.
A crime against humanity?
A crime against humanity.
When did you last fly, Anita? Can I ask you that? Okay, it's obviously a while ago if you have to think.
10 years ago. Maybe 10 years ago. And I know people give the argument, oh, we live on an island. You know, I there's places I would love to see in Europe that I haven't been, but like in time, I can get the ferry. All the electric sleeper trains are starting up all over Europe. You know, other countries seem to be maybe more aware than we are, but our attitude to flying and we can go where we like is ridiculous. You quibble over paying 30 cents on the plastic bag or whatever, and yet you get into a plane and belch out thousands of kilos of carbon into the atmosphere. Remember, there's no chimney, there's no plug hole, and we have this tiny, delicate little film around our Earth. Go up 8 kilometres and it's gone. You can't survive, and we're poisoning it by the day. We're faced with a decision all the time. What am I going to clean my toilet with? Are you going to put every chemical down the loo out into the water system? Or could you use a biodegradable product? You know, we have choices all the time. But it's up to each individual has got to realise it. If you want your child, your grandchild, to have some habitable planet, and we've such a fabulous planet, we have got to stop what we're doing now. You stop a losing game, and I better shut up because you can't get.
I'm just wondering: are they birds I can hear in the background, Anita?
Yes, the house sparrows.
Where are you right now?
Well, I was just potting up all the acorns from last year have, you know, germinated, so I'm just putting them to bigger pots. I'm just outside in the garden.
And what will you do with those potted acorns then?
Well, I try and plant a tree every day, so 365 days in the year. You know, I just made a decision a while ago. We've got the facts. What can each simple, you know, ordinary person do? I can plant an acorn every day. Well, now what I do is I grow them up, and when they're about 5 years and can survive, I plant them out. So I plant native trees, and I'm just really careful what I use, and avoid plastic at all costs. I just try and do my own bit.
I just love that idea. A tree a day just sounds... it's such a simple thing, but it is, if everyone did that, it would transform the country and transform the world. Where do you find to plant them? Can I ask you that?
Well, there's wild woods near me, and beyond that, then there's Quilter Plantation. So, I mean, there's no life in there. So with ash dieback now, every time I see a dead tree or a tree that's come down, I'll replace it with either an Irish or, you know, a native Irish oak or hazel or whatever else I have.
And you just, you harvest those, the acorns yourself, you don't buy saplings?
No, just go for a walk in the park. Katie, or well, where I would collect them is John F. Kennedy Arboretum, because you know the trees are very good quality there. So I would go and I'd find the Irish oak, which is Quercus petraea. You see, our oak is different to the English oak, and I just try and plant those and just try and do some little healing in one little spot in the ground. And most of the ground that you dig to plant a tree around the place, you find the earth is dead, there's no worms, it is very disheartening. And if you look at the bigger picture, you would just give up, you know, you'd get very down. But that's why I just think everybody, we've got to look after our own little bit. So that's all.
Thank you for that, Anita. I really appreciate that. And I'll just, as I say, I just love that idea of a tree a day. So you've 365 trees.
Look, some days I plant five, and then other days I won't get out. I won't manage. You know, I'll be working or doing something else.
But you tip away at it one way or another.
I just try. My bit is I won't fly. I try and plant a tree every day. I will not use plastic if I can. I mean, I can't fathom buying plastic windows. And I just, over the years, I'll buy one window a year and put a wooden window in, a carbon sink, and try and... maybe it's just me, maybe I'm loopy, Casey, but every time I'm faced with a decision, I just say, well, what can I do for it? What is the better thing to do?
What will do the
rather
least harm?
Or what is just going to give me immediate satisfaction and give me, or spend less money? Or, you know, we've got to think of children, the future, and this fabulous planet we live on and the fabulous country we live on. I mean, we live in the Goldilocks country. We really do. And all you do on Liveline is give out about it. Honest to God, Joe Duffy, I throttle him. He just wants to stir. Our country is fabulous. We have a green country still. And we've got to just mind it. And if people could just stop their husbands going out with the backpack now with all the chemicals and... you know, chemical warfare along outside their gates and in their gardens. Just remember, the insects and stop using the pesticides, insecticides.
Okay, well, we have a call hanging on exactly that point, actually. Anita, thanks for that. And well done on the little forest you've planted already and the many, many little forests that are to come. Pat, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Casey.
Pat, you, because we were talking yesterday to a beekeeper about, you know, the huge stress that the honeybee population is under. But you're concerned about other pollinators, you say, we need to think about.
We're concerned about all pollinators, and that includes solitary bees, bumblebees, butterflies, moths, and even the common fly. And I think, listening to your last caller, I think one thing we're all missing out on is people don't know right from wrong. And I think it all boils down to education and educating people as to what's out there. Because if they are educated, they will learn more. And I must compliment Cork City Council and other councils who have now decided not to use herbicides and insecticides on their properties.
You would think that should just be a given or a right across the country now, in terms of public areas at least.
Exactly, yeah. People just don't know, and they don't realise the damage. What's actually the problem out there is there's a lack of habitat and there's a lack of forage for all the insects. Now, the knock-on effect on that is bird life, which your previous was speaking about. If there's no insects and there's no food there for them, that's why their numbers will drop down as well.
It's a whole, and the biodiversity, as we know, it is one thing collapses and everything falls behind it.
Exactly, yeah. And we must also compliment the National Biodiversity Centre for all the information they're putting out there as well, for people to educate themselves on. But really it boils down, look, the future generation is our children. They need to know better. If they know better, they hold the power in all of this.
Now, we are on the brink of No More May. It's tomorrow's the 1st of May. And obviously we've been hearing about this in recent years now, that because of the time of year it is in particular, that people should leave the lawn mowers in the shed and leave their lawns do what lawns would do if they're left to their own devices. What do you say to people who say, look, I'm all for doing my bit, but I don't want to, you know, seed my entire garden to, you know, to let it all go to wild? Is it any good if you just do, you know, a patch?
I would recommend everybody to have one, even if it's a square metre, in their garden just for wildflowers, and that will support the insect life that's out there. But if everybody did it, look at the acreage you would have in it. And also, I'm involved with the Irish Bee Conservation Project, and we run a campaign at this time of the year coming into May for a clover sowing campaign. So people will still have their lawns, they can still cut the grass at 50 millimetres, and they'll have lovely white clover flowers coming up in the middle of summer to support all the pollinators.
Okay, so that's another thing we can do. And it's a bit of a theme developing here. Anita with her tree a day, and you're saying one square metre of unmowed lawn could make a big difference if everyone did it.
Exactly, because you say, for instance, you have 1,000 houses and they all have a square metre. That's 1,000 square metres. Now you've increased, that's a huge area. You know, and I just think people don't know, and they just need, it's education, as I say, they need just a little bit of education. And do you know, I'm going to actually tell you something now, in 2020 there was 20 tons of insecticides spread in Ireland. Now that is astronomical. You know, so that has an effect on all the insect life there. But if people just look, if they think before they spray, I think, and there are organic sprays you can use if they're trying to knock weeds down or anything like that, or just simply pull them. You know, maybe we've just become a lazy society.
Okay. Pat, thanks for that. I want to get in Barbara, if I can, on a similar theme. Barbara, good afternoon.
Hiya. Hello. Yes.
Yeah, your issue is hard landscaping of gardens.
Yeah, it's just an observation. I mean, the last man talking there about leaving bits of your garden for the wildlife, I'm concerned that the gardens are not being left at all. In my neighbourhood, there's a trend now of taking out large front gardens, and they're being beautifully landscaped with limestone and sandstone and recessed lighting and tree palms and all types of things. But I don't believe that that is any good for us and good for the environment or good for any of our small creatures. And listening to, you know, how global temperatures are going up, we just had it on Clareburn this morning, and agreeing with what Anita is saying, like, we have to start kind of with ourselves, and if we can hold on to as much of our greenery as possible, that'll be better for everything. And I mean, I understand people needing driveways, but I'm talking about gardens that already have driveways, and it's more like a fashion trend, I think, now. So in some cases, it's because maybe there are landlords and they don't want to be cutting grass. But then what happens
some
is
people, Barbara, to be fair, some people maybe aren't gardeners and just don't know how to manage a living garden, and this is something that will, you know, can look smart but won't demand attention.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, like the last man said, that really they're not aware. I don't think anybody's deliberately setting out to harm, but they're not actually aware that what they're doing is increasing the temperature of the city. You know, there's that thing of the heat island effect. They're actually increasing the amount of CO2 in the neighbourhood, and it's a double whammy. Like, the grass, the soil, the plants, the flowers they took out does the exact opposite. It actually cleans our environment, cools down the temperature. So maybe perhaps having a simpler type of a garden, just a square rectangle of grass, and putting down your driveway around the rest of the way, but keeping something to try and mitigate it, or not to be doing it for a fashion trend because it looks nicer when it's actually harmful. So that's just my point.
Okay, Barbara.
I just noticed it.
Thank you for that. We'll see if anybody else has a view on that. Thanks for that, Barbara. And Patrick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, we mentioned greenways there, Patrick, and the idea of, as I think I said when I was talking to Shea Bourne earlier on, paving paradise. You're a big fan of greenways.
Sorry?
Are you a fan of greenways, Patrick?
Yeah, I would be a fan of greenways, but I also understand the other people, what they're saying as well, like, about the paradise of the greenways as well, like, but... I find them good. We have a new greenway open now from Shannon Harbour, and it connects into Dublin. And I've cycled it now a few times myself and my partner Rita in the last three or four weeks. Like, and we find it very beneficial. It's good, safe roadway, and it's all along the Grand Canal there. So it is a huge benefit, and it's very busy now at the moment. The last 3 weeks we were up there for three Sundays. There was an awful lot of people walking it, cycling it, and it's a good, safe amenity to have. And there's no interaction with traffic or any sort of health and safety issues either. Like,
yeah, you see, I'm kind of torn by it because I do think there is something about, particularly for kids who don't have this on their doorstep. It's a great way to bring children out into the countryside and to see nature close up. But I do kind of wonder, in some cases, are we, you know, would we be better off leaving nature to, you know, to itself? And particularly, as Anita was saying earlier, the coastal paths that she says they are putting stress on already under stress bird populations.
Yeah. Well, there was always a sort of a roadway along the Grand Canal. The only thing now is it has been improved more with a proper surface on it that you can cycle on it and walk on it in better comfort. And even people can use prams and different wheeled equipment easier. Like,
is it actually tarmacked?
It's tarmacked now. It's actually tarmacked. As far as I understand, it's tarmacked the whole way from Shannon Harbour to Dublin, and as far as I know, and I'm subject to correction on this, I think it links in with the Royal Canal somewhere along the way. So that would bring it back the other way, maybe back towards Longford on that direction as well.
When you say Shannon Harbour, is that down in, that's the Offaly, Shannon Bridge?
Shannon Harbour, County Offaly, It's in West Offaly. It's about 3 miles from Banagher, about 4 miles from Shannon Bridge.
And it runs all the way from there up to Dublin?
Yeah, along the Grand Canal, and it's a great amenity to have, and it's very safe for the likes of us because we have fairly direct access to it. I live close to Clonoly Castle, and once I get onto the road there, within 5 or 10 minutes, I'm onto the Greenway. And last Sunday, we cycled from my house at Clonoly Castle up to Pulla and return. So that was roughly, I would say, 2 hours of a journey there. So it is, and you see some lovely scenes along the way, along the Grand Canal there, and there's some great visions there.
It's obviously a lovely part of the country, and they're all in lovely places. I know we've a new one down the Kerry direction, and I know the course, the Achill to Westport one is probably the original popular one. Do you think, though, that we might be going too far with it? That there's a point at which we'll say, okay, stop now with the greenways. We've done.
I suppose every town or village you go to now, there's some type of a greenway or a walkway or a pathway like that. Because I remember back when the greenway opened up in Westport to Achill, I remember cycling that there. That was 45 kilometres, and that was one of the first greenways that opened up in the country, And the next thing, it took off at an awful speed, and I was just a bit concerned that it was taking off too rapid, that everybody was putting in greenways all over the place. But look, they're well used. I'm involved now with our local community group in Belmont and County Offaly. It's BHM, Community Development Group, and that celebrates 25 years this year of community development. We work with all the different agencies throughout Offaly, like Waterways Ireland, Offaly County Council, Offaly Local Development Company. And we have a huge emphasis on biodiversity. This year we planted 150 native trees throughout the whole Belmont area.
Okay, that's again, there's some great work being done on people planting trees. I really think this is a big new development, that the appreciation of trees and all sorts of groups and individuals going out there and just actually putting trees into the ground. It's great.
Yeah, and even the other day now, I was in touch with our Offaly County Council biodiversity officer with a view to having a more intensive plan for biodiversity and wild gardens throughout the whole area of Belmont and the West Offaly area. So
when we come down next year, Patrick, we'll be looking out for all the wild gardens and the...
You're very welcome down, and it's a beautiful area, and there's some lovely pubs and coffee shops along the way, so you won't be let out.
Okie doke, Patrick, thanks. We look forward to it. We'll take a break there.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And there is a lovely piece in The Independent today about recipes that go way back in time, way back even before the famine, really extraordinary stuff like blackberry pie or blackbird pie, I should say, and sheep's brains and stewed eels. And it got us talking and thinking about memories, how food memories are so powerful and so strong, and that is, it will immediately take you back to a place and time of your childhood. We got some callers in. Vera, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing?
Now, Vera, I mentioned to Shay earlier that I remembered drisheen being made in our house as a very small child. And I was wondering, was it a particular Kerry delicacy?
No, not at all. I think Cork could be Kerry in the type of drisheen.
In everything, Vera, I'm sure you'd say. it is a Cork thing as well, of course, isn't it?
Tolka Cork, yeah, absolutely, very much so. And they have they had a family-owned stall in the English market going back all the years that I can remember, ever before the Queen came to visit or made it famous. And it's still there today.
And you say, and just because some people might not know, Vera, what are we talking about when we're talking about drisheen?
On it. My sister is really the expert, but I just wanted to give her the credit for There's five of us there in family, and she cooks it every month, delivers it, buys it, cooks it, and delivers it to us every month, okay? And we all, as a family, we all absolutely love it, okay?
What? Just explain to people.
This is another thing.
Yeah. Huh? Just explain to people the kind of.
She boils the tripe separately in water, and then the brasheen is cooked in milk with onions and slightly thickened and seasoned.
And is the drasheen, so is it the same drasheen that I'm thinking about? With where
it's made like a pudding, like a smooth pudding with no bits or anything in it. And
but is there blood in it?
Cut into chunks.
Is it a blood pudding?
Yes.
So where does your sister get the blood?
Oh, she doesn't have to. It's sold in the tripe and drasheen stall.
It's
a speciality tripe and drasheen stall in the English market.
I'm with you now, Vera. She doesn't make it from scratch. She cooks
she just buys the ingredients and cooks it. Oh no, she's a legend now, but not that much of a legend.
I was very impressed. I thought she was acquiring buckets of blood every month to make drasheen from scratch.
And no, she'd be out for my blood now sometimes, all right.
And you have it with tripe. Now I have to say, I will eat the drasheen. I will eat black pudding any day of the week. I have never gone so far as to eat tripe.
It's a together dish.
Mm-hmm.
The tripe is cooked separately and drained off. Okay, in water and drained off, and then the drasheen is cooked in milk, and then the tripe is added to the milk and slightly thickened. And if you want to make a more substantial meal, then if one wishes, they can put a bit of potato, cooked potato, into it, you know, to have it. They just crusty bread really for breakfast. We used to have it long ago as kids instead of a fry. Maybe alternative Sundays, like a fry one Sunday and the tripe drasheen the following Sunday.
And the smell of that, is there a very specific...
Oh my God, I was, my late husband, I was married to a Tipperary man. I was not allowed even cook it in the house, okay?
I'm actually not surprised, Vera.
Yeah, we used to go down to our mother's on Saturday morning and we'd have it down there. Now, and my children today, well, my young men today, my children, they couldn't abide it.
But you love it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I absolutely love it. And, you know, if you're not feeling the best or anything, like it's a great tummy settler.
That is very counterintuitive, I have to say now. But so you eat a sheep's stomach to settle your own stomach.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It does work, I can tell you.
And
I know for a certain fact, because I'm on a restricted diet at the moment due to a bit of a health problem. And it just has been amazing for me, you know, getting my... on my way back to my full health, please God.
And do you think the fact that it is actually on sale there in the English market now, do you think there is a bit of a grow there now for these kind of nostalgic foods that we maybe wouldn't have had?
This stall is going for years, Katie, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was born in 1947 and my dad owned a pub across the road from the English market, which I was actually born over the pub, okay?
My God,
Going back for as long as I can remember, like that, I would have a memory to remember. We remember having tripe and drasheen got from the English market. So it wouldn't be one of these new swanky stalls like the olive, the Mediterranean olives and all this. No, this is going back all the years.
And do you think that the demographic, the age group that would be lining up for this stall now, would it be other people born in the 1940s perhaps?
Yes, unless they were introduced as they were younger and had to grow up to it and will continue it on. But then that again depends on what partner they'd have, whether the partner would stomach it or not.
Because it is interesting, I think every food culture has particular things, like whether it's pig's heads or sheep's brains or whatever, if you're not of that food culture, like, how is that loved?
Yeah, well, I'm a Carbonian, and crude beans were a great Carbonian dish as well, but like, we never had them. That was one thing that we didn't stomach, you know. But there's other families that wouldn't stomach the tripe regime, but they'd love crude beans.
And I remember a family that used to love the pig's head, and you'd when you'd call in to this family, the pig's head would they'd always have a pot on with a pig's head on the go.
Yeah. My father had greyhound flango, and I remember I have a memory of a primal stone being out in the back garden with the pig's head being cooked for the dogs.
Again, I'd say the smells are something else there.
Unbelievable, yeah. You see, that's why she's such a legend, my sister Mary. Like, she does it all and delivers it beautifully, okay? All hygienically wrapped, everything, and that's her good deed to all of us once a month, and we are so appreciative of it, because I don't think, apart from her, there's two boys and two girls, and neither my other sister, like, who spent years in England, like, she wouldn't even know how to go about cooking it, you know. And I wouldn't be cooking it myself now.
But isn't it a lovely family tradition and something to bring you all together as well?
There's a bit of drop of cream goes into two of hers, I know. I have to give you Mary's phone number one time, and she'll give you all the details, but because I wouldn't take for 1 minute her expertise of the cooking, because she's the expert.
Right. And you wouldn't ever think, I'd better learn this recipe myself in case I ever have to make it for myself?
No, not really. I just keep getting keep going.
Because you've got Mary there delivering it once a month. Why would you? Says you.
Exactly.
Listen, we hang on, Vera. I've got a couple of other people with other great. Can I bring in Mary? Mary, good afternoon. Or is it Mary or Marie?
It's Mary. Good afternoon.
Mary, good afternoon. Box tea, you remember as a child?
I do, yeah. Very well.
And again, just for in case people don't know what we're talking about, it's would you call it a potato pancake? What would you call it? How would you describe box tea?
Well, yeah, I suppose it's a potato pancake. It's made using grated potatoes. And to that you add plain flour and baking soda. And when you have a dropping consistency, you fry it on the pan in stork. And
stork.
Turn it over.
Was it important to fry it in the stork?
Yeah, that gave it, I think, the best flavour. I suppose you could do it in olive oil and butter, but nah, that's too modern. So stork, number one. Always fry it in stork. And it's usually nicer day two. You can eat it straight off the pan, but the second day it's even better. It fries up a lot more crispy.
Do I hear a hint of an English accent there?
Well, maybe Welsh, because I live in Llandudno in North Wales.
Ah, but yeah. You grew up in Ireland?
Sligo, in Ballintore, County Sligo.
Is box tea specific? It's a very west of Ireland.
Yeah, it's Sligo, Leitrim, Donegal and the Cavan thing, I think, mainly. Mm-hmm. But in Cavan, they do what they call a boiled box tea, which is a lot more of a faff and a fuss. My friend Monica, her mum used to make boiled box tea. And when I observed it being made, it seemed to take too long. Mm-hmm. The Sligo method and the Leitrim method is much easier.
Would you still make it?
Oh, yeah. Not that frequently, but every now and then. And especially if I'm having people over from Ireland, would you believe? Cold to Newcastle and all that. I make them a little bit and they love it.
And
mother is gone now.
Would you still get the stork to fry it in?
Oh, yeah. You can buy stork, no problem. Yeah.
Isn't it amazing, though? Again, a box tea is another classic comfort food, though, isn't it?
Yeah. If you're hungry, nothing like it. Yeah. With a bit of bacon, cheese, whatever. Or just plain old butter. Can't beat it.
I see you have beef shin stew as well, was another one in your house.
Yes, delicious. When Mother used to have that ready for us when we come in from school, and the fat in the shin, oh my God, melt in the mouth. Yeah, can't beat it.
Yeah, it is one of those winter warmer things that you'd be hoping would be on when you'd be walking home from school.
Absolutely.
Can I bring in, thanks for that.
That's no problem.
Okay, thank you very much, Boxty. That's Boxty. Where are we going to? Margaret. Margaret, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Lamb's tails. Have I got that right?
You have indeed, yes. Yes. Many years ago, and I was dating John, who ended up being my husband, and the first time he brought me to Mayo, his mother said she would cook me a treat. And she cooked lamb's tails.
Lamb's? I never heard that before.
I had never heard it before, and I never wanted to hear or eat them again, I could tell you. But one was trying to impress, and so she would take the tail and she would burn it on the gas ring to get the wool off it.
Oh.
And then, and then boil them. And then put them on a plate, and I won't tell you what they looked like, Katie. It's a family show, but it was the most vile thing I have ever eaten.
Is it an actual, like? Is this something that people in that part of the country do eat?
Not anymore. And I think she was one of the last ones to do it. In fairness, but I mean, you know, when I said it to other people down there, they were like, "Oh yeah, I remember having lamb tails. I mean. You know, it, as I say, it's died out completely. But I suppose waste not, want not. But, oh, my God. I'm still laughing and thinking about it and sitting there wondering, how am I going to eat this and not insult the woman, you know?
What I'm trying to... Two things I'm wondering about right now is, did all the wool come off first? So it was actually just meat when you finally ate them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The second thing is, what was the consistency? Like?
Oh, God. It was like a very grizzly boiled sausage. It probably wouldn't be our place in Coddle, which is another I wouldn't eat. But it was like a pale pink sausage, and the consistency was like, as I say, kind of like how do I put it? It wasn't like pure meat, because obviously there's a small bone in there, mm-hmm. In the tail.
Yeah.
So it was kind of rough, would be one way of putting it.
But are you is the idea that you eat the whole thing, the bone at all?
Yeah.
I know. Okay.
Because there's not a lot of meat on it now, in fairness.
Yeah.
And it's boiled. I can't remember. Like, she must have boiled it for quite a while. That's the only thing I can assume. And you know, the lambs would have been quite young, but... she put like, I think, about half a dozen on this plate in front of me. I will never forget looking across at my then boyfriend for inspiration, wondering, was there a dog under the table I could feed to or something?
And was that the one and only time you had to pretend to like this?
Yes. 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 Thankfully.
Do you think your boyfriend had a word?
I think he was afraid I was never going to come back to Mayo, to be honest with you.
Okay, well, congratulations, Mark, because you actually have taught me something. I have never, ever heard of anybody cooking lamb's tails before. I wonder, is there an Irish word for it or a technical word for it? Or was it introduced to you as lamb's tails, yeah?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, and she was, I suppose the thing about it was, Katie, she was so proud of this and really thought she was giving me a treat, as if, you know, she had saved them specially for me.
Well, isn't it lovely, though, in one way?
Yes. There was I dating her only son, and she gave me the precious lamb tails.
Yeah, that was a signal. You were in. You had your feet under the table at that moment, Margaret. Listen, thanks for that. That is absolutely fascinating. Lamb's tails in Mayo. Okay, I'll take a break. We'll have more of these after that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're talking about our food memories, tastes and smells and textures that take us right back. And we've had some pretty unusual ones there just before the break. Can I bring in Mel now? Mel, good afternoon.
Hi.
Yeah, Mel, now yours has taken us back to more familiar territory, I'm glad to say. What is your food memory from your childhood?
Can I just say that if I came to Mayo and my husband served me lamb tails with his mum, I think I would have gone back to England and stayed there.
Right. I think a few of us might have run out the door.
Yeah.
What's your memory, Mel?
Yeah, my mother, God rest her, she would have been 78 now if she'd been alive. She used to make lovely gooseberry crumble.
Oh yeah, gooseberries. Now that's something you just never see around anymore.
Yeah. You don't see it much over here now. Yeah, gooseberry, green gooseberry crumble. It was delicious. She was a great old cook, God rest her.
And the gooseberries were very sharp, weren't they? They were,
but she used to sweeten them with plenty of sugar. We had to have a lovely big gooseberry bush in the garden at home in Hampshire. It was lovely.
Yeah, there is something very of its time of the goose. I don't even know. Do people grow have gooseberry bushes in their gardens?
I don't know. I don't really see them over here very much. We did have a small gooseberry bush in our garden here, but we live on a farm now, and I think my husband John dug it up a long time ago to plough the land.
Yeah. Baking smells. It's just something so comforting about the baking smells, isn't
there? Absolutely. Yeah. Like she used to make lovely liver and bacon casserole, lovely rice puddings, bread and butter puddings as well, and all those lovely smells. It takes you back, 20, 30, 40, 50. Well, not 20, but 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and the rice puddings, because I often tell my kids that the only time I ever saw rice as a child was in a pudding. That was like there was certainly no curry served with rice in our house. Every dinner came with spuds as nature intended.
Rice pudding served as a sweet, with the rice being soaked in the milk, and you had to have the skin on the rice pudding before you ate it. That was absolutely delicious. Now
it would be left on the range or even in the oven there for half of the day, just kind of soaking away, and then plenty of sugar,
and then with a bit of a dollop of strawberry jam in the middle.
Now, we never did the jam thing, but I did know that that was something other people did. But yeah. We went for the pristine, straight up rice pudding.
We were a household of five girls, so Mum was always cooking, bless her.
We were a household of five girls and three boys.
Okay, yeah, no, we had no brothers, just five girls.
So, yeah, and there was a lot of baking when I think of it. I mean, the amount of baking that was done in our house, just keeping bread going.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was that's the smell of a kitchen that you just know that there's lovely things happening in it.
Absolutely, yeah. And you never forget those smells. You could be doing something completely different, walking down the road, and you might smell something like that. Or if you're out shopping, you might smell something. If you go into a restaurant, you never forget those smells.
Yeah, absolutely, Mel. Mel, thanks for that. Thanks for sharing that with us. Gooseberry crumble. I want a bowl of it right now. Can I bring in Dara now? Dara, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Katie?
Good. Okay, Dara, I see you are...
We're sitting here in Galway, and you're making me and my mommy hungrier and hungrier as you go on. until you mentioned the skin on a rice pudding, whereupon I just immediately went green and said, no.
That's one of those ones that divides the crowd, all right?
Yes, we're on different sides of the divide on that one, I can tell you. By the way, it was lovely to hear somebody talk about Boxty. My great my granddad was a great Boxty fan. We used to make three types of Boxty. There was boiled Boxty, fried Boxty, and Boxty pancakes. So nice to hear people talking about Boxty again.
Yeah, I had never heard of boiled Boxty actually until today, but apparently it's a lot of faff, so maybe we're better off with the fried variety. your thing is offal, am I right?
Yeah, well, we were always, I have to say now, we have farming relatives, and when we were younger, we would sometimes, different cousins would club together to buy an animal between us. And we were always brought up that if an animal was killed to eat, you ate it, every piece. Now it's fashionable to say you eat it from nose to tail, but that was always the way we did. And some of the offal was absolutely our absolute favourite dish. I think my favourite memory, and I still make it to this day, would have been let's say on a Sunday, as you were saying, the oven would be on to do big baking. But mm-hmm. if the oven went on a Saturday, that was for probably something that could roast in about 40 minutes. And usually it was roasted hearts. So lamb hearts or pork hearts. Or I've even done beef heart, but that's the size of a chicken, stuffed with bread and onion stuffing, wrapped in bacon, roasted away in the, like any kind of a roast, and sliced and eaten. Oh my goodness, just absolutely, absolutely delicious.
I'd say now there wouldn't be a lot of go for hearts in butcher shops these days, would there?
Well, there is. It depends on where you go. I mean, another favourite of mine is chicken hearts that I would put on a skewer with, wrap a piece of bacon, crisscross a piece of bacon and have a skewer full of chicken hearts. You get that in a lot of butchers. Now, you won't get it in Tesco's. But of course, you'll still get your lamb liver and that in Tesco's and Dunn's, which is also absolutely fantastic, fried, soaked in a bit of milk, rolled in a bit of flour and fried with some bacon. Yummy.
Yeah, we would have had the liver from time to time at home, for sure. I think when there'd be worries about iron levels in the household, I think the liver would be brought out. But
the trouble is, we used to cook the liver in those days till it was like chalk. It was the most horrible, shoe leathery chalk. Actually, if it's just cooked for 3 minutes, it's wonderful. But I have to say, it's funny, different cultures. I mean, I had a lovely friend in Belgium, and when I went to visit her one time, she was ill at the time, and she said, before you go home, you must go to this particular restaurant in Belgium. Gosh, where were we in Belgium? I can't remember what town we were in. Brussels. And we had to order the speciality, which was lamb brain.
Ooh.
And we did, because we were trying to be dutiful. And the thing came out, and it looked like a brain on a plate. And it was the only time in my whole life that I nearly balked. And I was with a friend who was a real meat and two veg. But because I never balked, she just said, well, I know you're going to make me eat it, so let's dig in. And it turned out to be absolutely delicious. It's all in the mind, pardon the pun.
Oh my God. So what did it taste like?
It was a slightly interesting texture, a sweetbread kind of texture. Mm-hmm. If you've ever had lamb's testicles or anything like that, you know what I mean. Kind of slightly spongy, but very tasty. Not like any other meat I can think of. Organ meat is kind of different in that regard. Now we have the... Half your listeners are now passing out on the floor. But if you really want an interesting dish, I have friends in Pakistan. I've been many times. They've got this wonderful dish called tikka taka, because that's the noise the knives make on the big cooking plate out in the street. So you hear this noise and you know, oh, there's a tikka taka being sold over here. And the shells behind it looks like rows of snooker balls, reds and yellows and whites. But as when you order, they take down a red one, which is a tomato, a white one, which is an onion, a green one, which is a pepper, a pink one, which is a beef testicle, a purple one, which is a beef kidney. And with lots of oil, chop all that up and fry it until it's like almost crispy mince, and put it into a bread and give it to you. And I'm telling you, you'd smother your mother for it.
Oh, okay. So beef testicle and what was the other meat involved?
The other meat was kidney.
Okay, so beef, so cow's kidneys and
a bull's testicle, and onion. You can put the recipe on the website later. One full onion, carefully chopped.
Finely chopped onion, okay. Yeah, and beef tomato.
Pepper. Chili. Oil. You're going to make this at home, and if it's good, I'm coming over.
I'm going straight home and trying that. Okay, Dara, thanks for that.
The thing to anything, by the way, is please fry it, don't boil it. The difference between a fry and a coddle, you know, fry it's delicious, boil it, good food for blind people.
Indeed, that is a good point, because you do eat with your eyes, there is no doubt about that as well. Dara, thanks for that. I have to take another break here. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And more and more calls coming in, people's memories of food and interesting food that they've had over their time. And I want to bring in Mairead. Now, Mairead, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Your one struck me, because I think every family has their favourite turkey stuffing. There is the family stuffing recipe that they go back to again and again.
And
exactly. After all that talk of testicles and tails, Katie, I'm happy to be talking about some stuffing. Yes, the stuffing that we had, we never actually put it into a turkey. We served it as a side dish. It's potato stuffing. And I've lovely memories of growing up at home in Killarney. And usually Mum would do all the cooking, but on Christmas Eve, Mum and Dad would do the potato stuffing themselves, you know. And I've memories of just Santa being on RTE radio in the background, candle lighting in the windowsill, Dad chopping spuds, you know, he'd peel them. He'd boil them first until they were laughing, as he called it, then peel them and mash them with a load of Kerrygold. And Mum would be making breadcrumbs and chopping onions very finely. So you'd have your breadcrumbs, your floury spuds, your onions, your sage, your thyme, and enough butter to make your last artery block up, you know.
Now, can I stop you? Because I always thought that this was something that we did that other people didn't do, and that we mixed in our house. Potato and bread stuffing were always mixed together. There was always breadcrumbs in the potato stuffing.
Yes.
And that was, and with thyme was a big part of that as
exactly.
well, and onions.
Yeah.
So you did, you have our family stuffing, Maurice.
No, you have ours, Katie, girl. Yeah.
Because I have been told for years you have to do one or the other, and I have always insisted, no, you can have both together.
No, exactly. And it's just the perfect mixture. And you know those big brown ceramic baking bowls. Mm-hmm. Mum was a great baker, and she would actually make enough potato stuffing to fill that to the brim.
Oh yeah.
So we'd go out back when midnight mass was actually at midnight and not at 9 p.m. Mum and Dad, myself and my brother, we'd go out to midnight mass, and we'd come back in, and Dad would have the potato stuffing made already, and he'd heat up a few bowls of that. So we'd have a small bowl of it then with very, very weak port wine. No, it won't break your pledge at all, pet. It's baby Jesus' birthday. And then so we'd have it the next day with the dinner,
children,
the Christmas dinner.
As children, you're given port with your stuffing.
But bear in mind, Katie, that when I was 4 and I was over in Tralee Hospital for 2 months with a collapsed lung and pneumonia, and when I came home, the doctor said to Mum, keep her home now until next year from school, but give her Guinness with milk and sugar every second day to build her up.
Oh yeah,
that was 1969, so a very happy childhood, what I can remember of it.
Oh my God, you have such lovely memories and such a lovely way of bringing back all that back to life, Mairead. I'm right there with you with that Christmas night. It's just, it's gorgeous, isn't it?
Just lovely. And potato stuffing then, we'd use it, you know, in, you know, the turkey sandwiches then on the evening of Christmas Day. Again, potato stuffing and that, just gorgeous, you know. So we never put sausage meat into it. And this, you know, I still make it. Like, I'm married now with a mead with my 4 kids, and they love it. And it is the centrepiece of Christmas Day, really, you know.
Oh, yeah. And for me, it's not. That's it. That's the Christmas. That's the real main flavour of the Christmas dinner. Is
exactly.
Get the stuffing right and everything else.
Yeah. And I think it's lovely to pass on these recipes and, you know, in the making of memories. A few years ago, my eldest girls gave me a book to write my recipes into, and the very first one that went in there was the potato stuffing.
Yeah, that's lovely. It's lovely, Maureen. Maureen, thanks for that. Really, really, really lovely memories of childhood Christmases in Kerry. Where will I go to next? Will I bring in Stephen?
Hi, Katie. Good afternoon. How are you? It's lovely to hear all the lovely memories around the country.
Isn't it, though?
And all the old styles of meat and everything. Yeah, it brought back an awful lot for me as well.
And what are your memories when you think back?
Thank you. I remember things like the spiced beef and the corned beef and the sweetbreads, which were sheep's brains being cooked in my grandfather's granny's house.
Did you eat the sheep's brains?
I meant the caveat up front, Katie. The only bit I ever ate was the liver with the fries.
Right.
So it would have been my grandfather and my father, God rest him as well, would have been eating these things, you know. He was the, he owned Munster Meat, so my dad worked with him and some of the uncles.
Oh, that's
so
why I was wondering
memories.
Who was spicing the beef and corning.
Yeah. But I remember carrying meat into the old market there, and some wonderful, wonderful old characters there. A lot long since gone, unfortunately, and delivering into Roach's stores that used to be in Cork back in the day as well, you know. But I actually worked in the factory one summer, so your researcher Hilary there was just asking me about how they did the spiced beef and the corned beef. Basically, the spices is a secret recipe. There's a man, Tom Durkin, still does it down here. It's lovely. But it was just chilled for a few weeks, the beef. But the corned beef, there was a special recipe, and it was put in a vat, and the meat was injected every couple of days. So it ran right through the meat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also telling the crew beans, the pig's trotters. I think another caller mentioned those also.
Yeah, they drew the line at the pig's trotters, even though they were eating all sorts of everything. Wouldn't eat a crew bean either, would you?
No, but I remember going to Thurles for matches down to Semple, and there should be traffic jams all the way in, so that my father and his buddies would be out on the road drinking bottles of beer and eating crew beans out of silver paper out of the back of the car, you know. Yeah.
The match day out the back of the car, Americans call the tailgate parties. Ours was the hang sandwiches and crew beans in tinfoil out the back of the car.
That's it. The whole cortinas and stuff, you know. And you'd be waiting for about an hour and a half to get into the Turles at that stage for the match. Temple would be that filled and busy, you know. It was wonderful memories, yeah.
Great memory. Stephen, thanks so much for that. There's so many people I want to try and squeeze in as many as I can. I'll take a quick break now. We have a few more to come back to after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And let me go to Kathleen now. Kathleen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Pig's headband, yes. Cabbage, have I got that right?
No, pig's head and pig's tongue.
Oh, pig's head and pig's tongue.
Pig's tongue.
Okay,
now,
pig's tongue.
I grew up on a farm in Wexford, and we'd all sorts of tillage farm and animals. So we used to have pig's head, boiled pig's head and cabbage.
Yeah.
And the tongue was like the delicacy nowadays. The pig's trotters were, you know, very tasty, and I know a lot of fat on them, but they were very tasty. But I was in Cork recently, and it's all that sort of stuff in the English market. But
the English market still is the repository of all of this. Yeah, it's an amazing place. Yeah, the English market really is a treasure trove for foodies and for people who are nostalgic about the food of their childhood. What parts of the pig's head, I have a very strong memories of a family who used to really like to cook pig's heads.
Well, and it's like you halved it.
Yeah.
My mother, yeah, you halved it and boiled it. Now, it was very salty.
Yes.
And then the tongue, it's called with the delicacy part. Nowadays, it's a delicacy, rather.
And the tongue would be boiled separately and sliced, would it?
No, not separately. Like, you'd split the head, like half a pig's head, say, like kind of thing.
Yes, so you'd one ear, one eye, one nostril. I have a very vivid memory of this, but would you have half a tongue then if you were going that way, the tongue would go at one half of the head?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
And did you like it?
My mother, I did. Yeah, we loved it. But sure, in those days, like when I growing up, that time you didn't have a choice. Like nowadays, kids are too finicky about their food, and you know, but you just. Had to eat it when it's put on the table. And so it was lovely.
If I cooked it for you today, would you eat it?
I would, yeah. Now, we're a family of 11. A lot of mouths to feed, you know.
And it was probably cheap enough food, was it, at the time?
Oh, it was at the time. Well, we had our own, we made our own butter. And we had tillage farm as well, you know, barley, wheat and all that, oats, sugar beet, turnips, mangels, that's probably, I can't think of many more now. Onions and everything, sure. Lettuce, our own lettuce.
What did you do with the sugar beet?
The sugar beet was brought to, when we loaded it, I often loaded it before I went to school, and it was brought down to the train station, Wellington Bridge, which is closed now, and that went off to the sugar factory in Carlow, I think.
Carlow, I'm trying to remember. We all learned in school the four sugar beet factories.
That's
Carlow,
right. I think Carlow's Tuam, was it?
And it was...
I think Tipperary. Was there one in Tipperary?
There might have been.
I should know.
I would have known that at one time in my life.
I know.
Kathleen, thanks for that. Pig's head and pig's tongue. Okay.
And the trotters. The trotters were delicious.
Don't forget the delicious trotters. Okay, Kathleen, thanks for that. Who else can I get in? Can I get in Elner? Elner, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
Elner, you are... Oh, I see you're describing yourself as a Cork woman exiled in Kerry. For 60 years.
Yes, for the last 60 years. Yes. But great memories of Cork at the same time. I can remember the market, going down to the market for tripe, and I was always sent down on a Friday because that was brought home, and an early caller was telling you that about the smell and the tripe, and mm-hmm. there definitely is and was. And it was always... the first boil was the night before, Friday night, you see, so then everything was right for Saturday. So all you had to put in was onions in it and milk. And it only took a half an hour the next day to kind of boil it up and thicken it then with corn flour or whatever, salt and pepper, and away you go, and potatoes. And when you ran out of the spuds, you had some bread then after that, grand. So everybody was fed. But I have a funny story to tell about a lady that I brought up from Kerry one time with me when I was working here way back in the day. And we were sitting down for the Saturday lunch, which was tripe and potatoes. Mm-hmm. So she was sitting down and she couldn't look at it. And the rest of us were diving into it. The table, and like I had a kick under the ankle and the ankle to say, take the damn thing away from me. I can't take any more of this, you know. So I was never, but a funny thing, my husband here in Kerry, he absolutely adored tripe. So anytime I go back to Cork, I'd bring back pounds and pounds and pounds of it, as many as I could carry back with me.
I don't think I've ever seen tripe for sale in Kerry, actually. I certainly not as a child.
Well, I'll tell you what, very difficult to get it. There was a time when you could, but you could get it in Tralee, you get it in, there's a place called Waddington's who have it, I'd say, about, they'd have it fresh at least once a month or whatever, you know. And there was another place as well, McQuinn's down in, I'm not sure where they are now, down in Russell Street somewhere. They used to have it as well. They had their own tripe, but... The Waddingtons, I think, came from Cork, from the English market. But we never referred to it as the English market long ago. It was referred to as the market. Now, because I know there was the Irish market, which was down in the Colquay, which was referred to as the market always. But I had two jobs to do on a Saturday. My mother was a Kerry woman, of course. She was a Castle Island woman. So I had to come down and get the 2 pounds of tripe, which was put in, no plastic bags, remember, back in those days. So into newspaper... wrappings and wrappings and loads of newspaper and a string bag. I can still see the string bag. And then at the top of Oliver Plunk Street, there was a shop called Murray's, and I'd have to go up, and there was an order there for the Kerry edition of the Kerry Man, which I had to collect every Friday in Murray's to go home. And in those days, the tripe shop in the market was not where it is now. It was at the other end of the market near the lane where they brought you out to Mackesy's pub, which was in Oliver Plunkett Street. So that's where it was back in the day. And actually, the woman who ran the shop there was a neighbour of ours long ago, Mrs. Corbett. And that was those days, you know. But I do remember another dish, and I can't remember much about it except for skirts and kidneys. And the skirts were kind of the ribs of, I'd say possibly bacon. I'm not quite sure. Was it pork? I can't rightly remember. But I do remember it was an awful job trying to take the skin off the ribs before they were cooked, and it used to drive me around the bend.
Okay.
But my mother obviously had a favour of kidneys, because the skirts and kidneys, and then on a Sunday we always had a steak and kidney pie and her own paste. My mother was a domestic science teacher, so she was into all the angles, if you know what I mean, of those things. But anyway, those were the good old days. I loved it. I loved Cork, and I get a great kick out of it all the time going back there, do you know?
You clearly
still,
do.
I can remember going.
Yeah. Listen, Elner,
I'll
let you go, because I'm just trying to get... I've got a man here who I think claims that he also ate lamb's tail, so I'm just trying to get to him in our last few seconds. Elner, thanks for that. Sean.
How are you, Katie?
We have found somebody who has actually eaten lamb's tails.
Oh, the same as the Mayo crowd. We eat the lamb's tails as well. I can still smell the singeing wool. And I think my mother used to put them on and fry them on a pan. Maybe boil them a bit first and then fry them and have them with chali. Did you ever hear of chali?
Yes.
Mashed potato and scallion.
Yes.
And a good lump of butter, and they're beautiful.
You're seriously telling me that lamb's tails are a beautiful thing to eat?
Oh, they're a delicacy at the time. And you might get nothing else for the rest of the day, you know. So you have to eat them.
Okay. John, I have to let you go. We are all out of time, but thanks for that. The Sugar Factories, Carlo Mallow, Tume and Thurles. Anyone, a school child of that time, will know that. That's it. On sound today, we had Tommy O'Sullivan. Research was by Richie Byrne, and the programme was produced by Annette Egan. Stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.